The Source Podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. The number of Latino voters participating in the midterm elections doubled from 2014 to 2018, according to Pew Research. And there are indicators that show that Latino voters are going to continue to show up in big numbers in 2020. They could decide the next presidential election. But what are we talking about when we say Latino voters? And how did this demographic group come to be? Who is the Latino vote? What issues do they support? And why now are they energized? You can call in with your questions and comments. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. And you can tweet at us at @tprsource. We're joined this hour by Benjamin Francis Fallon, a professor of history at Western Carolina University. He's the author of the forthcoming book, The Rise of the Latino Vote, A History, is from University Harvard Press. Also with us is Olivia Talley, the senior reporter covering Latino issues and culture for the Houston Chronicle. Welcome both of you to The Source.
Thank you. Hi. Nice to be here.
So, Professor Francis Fallon, your book, The Rise of the Latino Vote, we can take it from the title that there is a thing called the Latino vote and it has risen, right?
I think it's, you know, your introduction said it very well. You talked about both Latino voters and the Latino vote. And I think what I would say and what the book tries to say is that while we've always had Latino voters, the notion of a Latino vote, and particularly a Latino vote that could really have the balance of power and decide presidential elections, is something more new, something that had to be built, and something that has been built over a series of decades since about the 1960s. So whether there is a Latino vote or isn't a Latino vote, people think there's a Latino vote, and people want there to be a Latino vote, and people want to win the Latino vote, and all that has influence on the American political system.
And Olivia Talley, at the Houston Chronicle, we're seeing in Harris County how a Latino vote is muscling up, particularly with their most recent election for county judge.
That's correct, David. Actually, the vote here in Texas, or Latino vote here in Texas, grew exponentially in many counties, even in north west counties. But in Harris County, it was really massive. We saw here even a little bit higher than the in the past the presidential elections in 2016. So actually double here in the midterms compared to 2014. And I am told by some analysts that this is not only in Harris County. For example, in Bexar County, the growth is not as much, was not as much, but you have to take into account that, you know, the Bexar County is you know, in San Antonio, is already very high Latino electorate there. So you will not see that kind of jump. But it's very interesting. I mean, and here you see a lot of mobilization. We saw a lot of mobilization in 2018 in the midterms without precedent, actually. Some investment here that we didn't see before, because the Latino vote is usually taken by granted here or totally neglected by both parties. But last year we saw something that many people saw as unprecedented in terms of mobilization, mostly from non-profit organizations, not necessarily affiliated with parties, although more left-leaning organizations, if you like. So the results showed a total, you know, Democrats won here almost every position.
Sure. It was a sweep of a lot of judges in the mm-hmm. Harris County Courthouse, but particularly with the county judge, with Lina Hidalgo.
Lina Hidalgo, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And she is an exciting young newcomer who stunned the political world.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember, you know, the beginning when she announced her her nomination. I mean, nobody actually thought that she had any chance, right? So, because she's very young, you know, not without a name already established, and we had a Conte George that was very popular here, you know, Emmett. So nobody paid attention to her. Nobody thought that she had any chance. She is a very, but she was a very, at the time when she was campaigning, very intelligent campaign, I would say, because she, I mean, I would see her in places that where you would know that not many people would be there, but she would be like, you know, tirelessly going to every corner that she could, you know, to reach out to organizations and people in the base. And by the time that it was closer to the elections, you know, analysts were starting to kind of say, we have to pay attention to this candidate.
Right. So people are saying the lessons that they've learned from her, and they are paying attention to what her campaign did, is not take the identity politics for granted. She wasn't going to assume that Latinos were going to vote for her simply because of who she is and her background, but she went out and she earned all of those votes. And when she did that, she was able to pull that political upset. Benjamin Francis Fallon, with your book, The Rise of the Latino Vote, there's a long history of people not understanding what the Latino vote is, what Latino voters want, and how to get them to the polls.
No, it's certainly the case, but there's also a long history that's, as you describe it, you know, the party elites, Democratic and Republican alike, have often puzzled or scratched their heads over what it is that Latino voters are about. And in the space of not really knowing, they've often made their own assumptions and tried to kind of mold Latino voters into their own kind of preferred positions. But it's also the case that Latino elected officials, and particularly like those that have just been described, operating at the local level, have done a lot to generate the possibilities for Latino politics, as you said, not by expecting people simply to vote for them on the basis of their appearance or culture, but also reaching across to non-Latinos to integrate them into multiracial coalitions around particular brands, usually of liberal politics. And that's sort of how the local level political organizing of the type that you've described is something that catches the eye of national political elites, who envision that these kind of grassroots actors can be the sort of foundation for a national Latino constituency.
And still, we're not even clear about what we mean when we say Latino constituency, because that can be broken down in multiple ways. Just looking at the surface level, Cuban Americans, Puerto Ricans, Mexican Americans, even Venezuelans, it can go on and on. And these, each group, they have own their own agendas and priorities, issues that they bring with them to the polls. So how do we talk about a common Latino experience for voters, and how do we talk about how this demographic breaks down into sub-demographics, even along age lines and gender lines? It gets really complicated really fast, and still politicians are trying to figure out, how do we bring in the Latino vote? And speaking Spanish on the stage during the debate may or may not be the ticket for that. We're going to talk about that. Our phone lines are open. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. What is your take on the Latino vote? Have you suddenly become energized? Usually you were just a presidential voter. Now you're interested in midterms. Or have you become even more energized that you're willing to work or donate or become a volunteer for a campaign? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay tuned. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Hispanic voter registration and turnout rates are increasing at a faster clip than rates for the general population, particularly in key 2020 states. That's according to an analysis of voter data presented by Univision this week. That report found that from 2014 to 2018, Hispanic voter turnout increased at a faster rate than non-Hispanic turnout in Arizona, Colorado, Georgia, New Mexico, North Carolina, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. Notice that Texas is not included in that group. Is Texas lagging behind with its Latino voter getting energized? What's happening with that? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980 as we talk about the rise of the Latino vote. Benjamin Francis Fallon, you talk about the history of the Latino vote, and it may seem counterintuitive for people to realize that there wasn't always this thing called the Latino vote, even though there were Latinos in the United States.
Sure, it really was a development that was spurred on by activists from around the country and elected officials that sought to unite really disparate Latino political communities. You were talking just a moment ago about, well, Mexican Americans and Puerto Ricans and Cubans and so on. These differences in self-perception, these differences in national origin, have always been and continue to be very important for Latinos as they evaluate politics. And so it was very much a process of building alliances, first among Mexican Americans from the Southwest, from Texas, from Northern New Mexico, from California, and for those elected officials, people such as Henry B. Gonzalez in San Antonio, Edward Roybal in Los Angeles, Joseph Montoya, a senator from New Mexico, they developed relationships with Puerto Ricans from New York and began to work on building institutions that would connect those populations together and would somehow convince the major political parties, the Democrats usually, to take them seriously, to really understand that they were somehow not just different people in different places, but one American people that had a destiny in the political system to really be the decisive voice, potentially. That was a process that unfolded from, you know, over a couple of decades, really beginning in 1960 with the Viva Kennedy campaign.
Well, the Viva Kennedy campaign for John F. Kennedy, and there is some connection between the Latino vote and John F. Kennedy, particularly on the Catholic connection that was strong. The campaign also got Jackie Kennedy to record a message in Spanish that aired on television. But when you listen to what the Viva Kennedy, what Kennedy was saying back to those supporters, he was talking about like foreign policy, how to treat Latin American countries, and he wasn't really thinking about the Latino community as a domestic, having a domestic agenda involving civil rights.
And certainly wasn't thinking about the burgeoning Cuban populations in the country as having anything to do with domestic agendas around poverty or really about civil rights, as you say. Those were issues that came to the fore in the 1960s, and particularly Mexican Americans saw the advances that African Americans appeared to be making under Democratic administrations and began to really put the pressure on Democrats to acknowledge that Mexican Americans first were a minority group, a national minority, something on par with African Americans. And then over a period of time, that notion of Mexican Americans being a national minority evolved and came to incorporate Puerto Ricans and, to a lesser degree, Cubans. So civil rights is definitely a key motivator for this kind of this development of a Latino political community. And it was one that Democrats definitely did not always appreciate. They didn't want to make room for an additional minority group. It cost a lot of Democrats enough to give what support they did to African Americans in terms of white votes, and so they were reluctant. And I think it's probably the case that we can still say that Democratic overtures to Latinos are calculated in terms of what they might cost elsewhere within the Democratic coalition.
Well, the old Democratic Party of Texas was very active in doing all it could to prevent Latinos, Mexican Americans from voting. It was very much involved in the suppression of the Mexican American vote and keeping that community from being organized and having political power. And so it took including Mexican Americans, Latinos in the Voting Rights Act as a protected class in order to start achieving some gains.
And this is one of the kind of underappreciated elements of what you just described, is that that was a process that was linked to developments among Puerto Ricans. Puerto Ricans were routinely denied the ballot in their core mainland population of New York City. There was a New York State literacy test that was applied to Puerto Ricans until 1965. And in so the first Voting Rights Act enfranchises a greater number of Puerto Ricans at the same time as it's operating to lift the disfranchisement of African Americans in the Deep South. And it's the initial growth of voting rights acceptance for Puerto Ricans that facilitates also this eventual extension to Mexican Americans in other states. And with that, the kind of broader idea of a what they called Spanish origin political community, a legal class that was protected in American democracy. So yeah, that's a big change from 1965 to 75.
But for 40 years, Texas had the whites-only primary system for the Democratic Party. You had to pay a poll tax, and then you had to, when you went to go vote, you had to affirm in person and sign a document that you were a white person. And this was also exclusionary.
There's no question that the old Democratic Party had a particular place for Latinos, and if Mexican Americans and Puerto Ricans were Democrats throughout most of the 20th century, the Democratic Party was their party, but they were in a very unequal position, and so it makes sense that in their unequal positions they sought allies, and they first sought allies among African Americans and other marginalized people in their local communities. And at some point after that, they began to find each other, again, Mexican Americans and Puerto Ricans, trying to turn the Democratic Party into something legitimately multicultural, legitimately not antagonistic to the idea of what we now call people of color participating in American democracy.
You write in your book, The Rise of the Latino Vote, about how the census, the U.S. Census, took a while to recognize the population of Latinos and being able to help people check that box. That's still controversial today, even as we're waiting an executive order. They may already have happened from President Trump trying to require people say if they're a U.S. citizen or not. So the U.S. Census has always been a challenge for Latinos and defining the demographic and also acquiring their rights.
No doubt about it. One has to appreciate that the census is especially important for communities that have large numbers of non-citizens, and therefore people who want to make their voice heard, want to be counted, need to exert some influence, but can't necessarily do it at the ballot box. And so census activism, efforts to get a legitimate and full count of the Latino populations were always really important. And, you know, a lot of people would be surprised to know that it was Richard Nixon who urged on in 1969, urged on the Census Bureau, forced census statisticians kind of against their will to create what was then a kind of a Spanish origin category, this kind of a precursor to the Hispanic category. Because prior to 1970 or so, the federal government really recognized Mexican Americans as being just a Southwestern people, and five Southwestern states was really all they tallied, and that recognized Puerto Ricans as being a people in a couple of Northeastern states. But this goes to the idea that officials in American life, the power players in American life, didn't really conceive of Latinos as a national people. And to some degree, this was because they hadn't yet found each other in important ways and hadn't forced Washington to see them as one.
Or there wasn't this creation of this Latino identity.
Yeah, it was something that had to be worked out. And it's a process that feeds upon itself. So the statistic is created, and that helps create a self-awareness. It creates a number of, this is how many people that exist that are this type of person. And so there's an element of self-reinforcing strength to those official decisions. The federal government says there are this many people. Well, now let's make that into power. How can we turn this many people into a decisive voice in American life?
And Olivia Talley at the Houston Chronicle, Houston, cosmopolitan city, is there some sort of unity among the different Hispanic groups in Houston that they work together, come together, or is it still divided, finely divided?
You know, David, I would like to kind of, and this is related, you know, to add to what Professor Francis Fallon was saying about the Latino identity. He actually did a great job in his book. I haven't been able to read it completely, but there is a thing that I had read. I am ready to read it completely as soon as I have it. But the point is, you know, when we talk about Latino identities, you know, historically, Professor had been, you know, commented very well, but these identities also are also evolving all the time. And in Texas, we are having, I would say, some trends that are changing what the Latino identity is in Texas. Before, Mexican Americans were the Tejano, as Professor Francis Fallon mentioned, you know, the Tejano breed of the Latino identity, the national Latino identity that had different characteristics in several parts of the country, but in Texas it was the, you know, the Tejanos, the Mexican-American, mostly born in the territory of Texas, or what is before Mexico, with an attachment to the land, etc. But now, you know, the identity of that, or the Latino identity, I see it, and the statistics are showing that it's sort of changing. Before were people that belong to the land. Now we have more people that are either immigrants themselves or children and grandchildren, so say first, second generation immigrants, people that still have a significant attachment to the countries of origin. And also there is you know, the Mexicans, while the Mexican population is growing, and it's not growing as much and as fast as populations such as, for example, South American populations, Cubans, Venezuelans, Colombians, people with you know, so the variety of the Texas Latino is increasing. And at the same time, the you know, the characteristics of these populations are also changing, you know, towards a more diverse, more internationally thinking population, if you like, you know, population that is very much interested in the relationships, for example, between Texas and Mexico, Texas and Central America. So that from one hand, so I think the identity of the Texas Latino population is slowly but surely changing, and that when you pair that with the fact that the politics of Texas are changing radically towards Latinos, we are having a sort of a situation that could become very energizing. A mobilizing factor in the upcoming election in 2020. We have politics in Texas that are showing more and more sort of a hostility towards, or at least is perceived by Latinos, many Latinos, as hostile to them. And such as, for example, you know, the passage of the I don't remember the numbers. The SB4 sanctuary, you know, and the sanctuary cities.
Sure, and that seems to be a debate that's being had now. Is do Latinos care about immigration issues, even though they and everyone that they may know and their family are not connected directly to immigration issues? But this has become an emotional attachment issue, and what does that look like, and will this impact the vote that's being debated by politicians right now. The number to call in, please join our conversation as we talk about the Latino vote and where is it going, 210-614-8980. We're going to be right back.
The U.S.-Mexico border is largely misunderstood by the general public. It's on the shoulders of border reporters to tell the stories of people separated by a 2,000-mile invisible line.
Unless you live there, unless you see it, and you see the ebbs and flows, I think people miss the larger context.
Two border reporters share their experiences next time on Fronteras. Download Fronteras wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the rise of the Latino vote. That's also the title of the book written by one of our guests, Benjamin Francis Fallon. He's also the professor of history at Western Carolina University. Also with us today is Olivia Talley. She's a senior reporter covering Latino issues and culture for the Houston Chronicle. I have an email from Luis. He says there is a misconception that Latinos vote Democratic by fault. There are a lot of Republican Latinos. The Democratic Party should not take us for granted. And to that point, you know, two of the most successful Hispanic politicians that we have in America, you could say, are probably Senator Marco Rubio and Senator Ted Cruz. So it does not fall directly along a party, you know, one particular party. Benjamin Francis Fallon, where is this rise of Latino vote? Who gets to get it?
I think, can you say that just in a slightly different way?
Yeah. Is any particular party going to be able to claim the Latino vote as theirs?
Oh, okay. Thank you. I think claim, it depends on what you mean by claim. If the question is to claim in the manner that African Americans devote the percentage that they do to the Democratic Party, no, I don't think those days are here. I think one needs to appreciate that for a really long time, most Latinos have been Democrats, but that for a really long time, the Republican Party has done what it could to recruit Latinos, not just to vote for Cuban American candidates, but to vote for Anglo candidates. So if we think back to the 1960s, someone as conservative as Barry Goldwater, the Arizona senator, when he ran for president in 1964, he had a Latinos con Goldwater auxiliary campaign, and he, you know, made a certain effort to speak Spanish on occasion and to reach out to Latino Democrats who they wanted to convert to the Republican Party.
He was conservative for his age. I don't know where he would fit in the political spectrum today, because he was particularly pro-Planned Parenthood. I'm going to go to one of our guests now calling in. The number is 210-614-8980. We're joined by Texas Senator Jose Menendez. And Senator Menendez, welcome to The Source.
Hey, thanks. It's always good to be with you. I just love listening to your program because I get to learn and every once in a while participate. So this is a fascinating and critically important topic right now, and it's one that I get sometimes frustrated hearing from some of my colleagues when they all say from time to time, when are your people going to start voting? And I tell you that it stings a little bit, but I'm not going to blame the constituents. I'm going to blame the fact that maybe we're not speaking to them. We're not saying the things that they're interested in. Maybe they're working two and three jobs at minimum wage, and they're struggling, and they just don't. And many come from countries where all the politicians are corrupt, or most of the politicians are corrupt, and they don't see that voting makes a difference. And I've heard that before. And so it's up to us to give them a reason to vote for us. And I think your question that I heard you pose to your guest was, will any party be able to claim? I think that's ridiculous. I think that's that type of arrogance. If any party or politician has that, they'll start to lose more than gain anybody. I think you have to every day earn the votes and the trust of the people you're asking to vote for you.
So, Senator Menendez, since I have you on the line, let me ask you about some of the issues in Texas that seem to be trying to inhibit voter participation in the Latino community, particularly making it very difficult, or more difficult than in other many other states, to register to vote, and then also not having as many early voting opportunities in some places, particularly where young people are voting. And questions about the voter ID, which is the strictest in the nation here in Texas.
Yeah, exactly. In this session, once again, I had to fight what I found to be some voter suppression legislation, trying to make people criminals for helping people with an early with a mail-in ballot. You know, that could possibly, if my mom, who's 83, requests a mail-in ballot, if she asked me to come over and help her with it, that maybe I would be a criminal, depending on how I manage it. Fortunately, we were able to keep that legislation from passing, but Texas has a long, long history of making it more difficult for people to vote in general. And I think when one of the things that I've observed, because, you know, I've been at polls on election days many, many times over the last 20 years, is that what I get so frustrated is on election day, sometimes when they move someone's precinct from one school where they've always voted to a different place, people go, well, that was the 30-minute window I had to vote. I have to go work now. And they just give up. And fortunately, in Bexar County, I'm appreciative of Bexar County and other counties in Texas that are taking it upon themselves to do what I had some legislation filed that you can vote on election day anywhere in the county, just like you would on E-Day. And I would like to see election day voter registration as possible as well, because we have the technology. And with how it, as difficult as we've made it to get a license, a driver's license in Texas, that we know that the people who have them are citizens. Therefore, they should be able to have, they should be registered and be able to exercise their right to vote.
All right. Texas Senator Jose Menendez calling in as we talk about the rise of the Latino vote today. Thank you so much for that. And I'm wondering if I can get your reaction. First of all, let's go to Olivia Talle, senior reporter covering Latino issues and culture for the Houston Chronicle, particularly your reaction to some of the issues regarding making it difficult for Latinos to vote. Is that something you've covered, you've noticed?
Mm-hmm. Well, there have been initiatives here in Texas. Well, the constant review of laws to put more, demand more or less qualify identifications to be able to vote, etc. As was just mentioned before. But there is a lot of controversy in that point. In the sense that, well, some people say, well, you know, if you really want to vote, what's the problem with having to show your ID, et cetera, no? And I understand that side of the discussion too, but we are kind of going backward instead of forward in terms of making things easier for not only Latinos but everybody. Texas has a very low participation turnout rate among all states. It's always in the bottom 10 or 15 states. I mean, and sometimes even the last ones. You know, so it's an issue that we should be, voters should be looking at what are the initiatives? What are the solutions that can actually make everybody in Texas vote more, because it's sometimes painful to see the low turnout, no?
Sure. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. Benjamin Francis Fallon, in your book, The Rise of the Latino Vote, A History, you use the phrase a sleeping giant. It's always in quotation marks, as some people have used that to describe the Latino vote. A lot of people have found that phrase also offensive, because this is not a population that doesn't vote because they are sleeping, mainly because, as Senator Menendez pointed out, many people are working. This is a working giant doing many things at once, and they may not feel like, and it's very difficult for them to get to the polls. So, is that changing?
Well, to your point about the origins of that term, that is definitely not my term, but that's a term that people began to use actually as early as the 1950s to try to, I think, explain sort of low participation rates or what seemed to be lower than necessary participation rates by Latino voters, and to kind of at least act as a kind of motivation, right? That that all that kind of needs to happen is that for this community to sort of rouse itself to sort of just take stock of its position and do stuff and start voting. But the reality is that that neglects the many ways in which the system has been organized to frustrate Latino political participation over time. As it's evolved, it's kind of like, as Ms. Talley has said, is sort of a way of kind of scapegoating Latinos in a way, holding them responsible for the party's lack of mobilization efforts, for people not really wanting to take the risks to be advocates on behalf of Latino issues. So I think the first thing to change that is to recognize that it's sort of a criticism of Latinos, but it's also been self-applied. Latino political activists have wanted to cast their people as a sleeping giant, because if the only thing dividing Latinos is not national origin, is not region, is not historical experience, but if the issue is that they have just failed to recognize the power that they could be, then it puts those other differences in out of the way, and that it points the direction toward a future together in which Latinos could exercise the influence that Latino leaders have wanted them to have.
Got a Twitter message from Denise. I'm forever frustrated by Latinx being lumped as a monolith by the pandering politicians and campaigns constantly do. Our cultural differences are vast. We care about issues that will affect us and our communities. Speaking Spanish isn't impressive. Olivia Talley, you're seeing some candidates speaking Spanish on the debate stage. Does that seem to be winning votes? Sometimes they speak it. It sounds more like Klingon, depending on who's saying it.
It's very interesting. But, it's a good try. I mean, we should not criticize, the listener that sent the tweet, the Twitter, I think she's right, no? Latinos are very diverse. I mean, that doesn't mean that, many of them do not speak Spanish at all. However, those who does, are appreciative of that. So it's a kind of a recognition of cultural heritage, you know? But so...
And then many are business owners, many are... they have all sorts of interests. We know that Latinos also are have the highest percentages of starting businesses. So they look, it's not just a one single entry point and definition for who this community is and who makes it up and what they want for and what they're going to vote for. Our number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. We're talking about the rise of the Latino vote. What do you vote for? What is your priority issue? What do you feel like candidates, how are they presenting themselves to the Latino community? Stay tuned. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the rise of the Latino vote. The number to call in to join the conversation, 210-614-8980. Benjamin Francis Fallon wrote the book, The Rise of the Latino Vote, A History. Now, there was a time when the Republican Party was very aggressive in trying to make overtures to the Latino vote, particularly George W. Bush was pretty good. And Greg Abbott here in Texas, our governor, seems also to continue along those lines. But still, we're having some hostility coming from other parts of the party. So what is happening with the Republican overture to the Latino vote?
Well, so I think it's always been the case that the Republican overture to the Latino vote, or as they first called it, the Spanish-speaking vote, was complex. And your earlier listener who tweeted about lumping everyone together should also know that while in public politicians talk about the Latino vote as kind of a monolith, very much in their strategy they are slicing and dicing and looking for the elements of it that are most congenial to their outlooks.
Sure, but what demographic is a monolith?
Well, fewer demographics are talked about as being so monolithic and yet being so diverse.
Well, you know, white evangelicals, you know, people call that, that's a monolith. But you're still, if I go into that community, I'm going to find somebody that didn't vote along the, you know, our predetermined values. So, you know, it's, yeah. But we talk about things in overall broad strokes frequently when we talk about demographics, right?
It's true. The way that politicians have, and Republican politicians, if that's the focus, have historically thought about the Latino vote is that that the goal for Southwestern Republicans, the Nixons, the Goldwaters, the George H.W. Bushes, and then ultimately those who succeeded them, was first to peel away Mexican Americans from the Democrats, and especially in Texas. Texas was the key to John Kennedy winning in 1960. Richard Nixon was terribly frustrated not to have won it in 1968. Texas was the prize for Republicans in changing it from a Democratic state. And a key component of that, they thought, was turning out Mexican Americans. And the thought process there was, you know, that Mexican Americans, they imagined to be culturally conservative, to be family oriented, to be against, you know, government intervention.
Yeah,
and
the line
and
that we
that
heard
nature.
From Ronald Reagan is that Latinos are Republicans; they just don't know it yet.
Yeah, and that was belied by his own polling. If one looks in the Reagan administration papers, you can see that when they actually do the work of surveying Latino voters, they find out, well, they're very religious, but they also believe that the government has a responsibility to, for example, help the poor. So. They want a certain thing to be the defining characteristic of the Latino voter, but then they always run into this reality that it's just more complicated than that.
We're having an energized Latino vote now, but it's also energized among Republican Latino voters and Democratic Latino voters. It's not just one particular party being able to take advantage of that. But I would love to know what Olivia Talley, senior reporter covering this issue at the Houston Chronicle, are you seeing more energy among potential Latino voters?
Well, there is last week the Latino Decisions Organization they are dedicated to study politics and surveys and analysis, and they put out a survey showing that the number one issue that Latinos in general are focusing on is healthcare, and immigration stands at the third. Point the third defining issue that they are considering to participate in the elections. But in the difference between the two the three top issues is very small. So it's between 46, 47, 44. You know, percent of people that saying that issue in particular is the first one. So it's not. That significance. Bottom line, the three main issues are healthcare, immigration, and education. Here in Texas, in Texas, we are seeing a lot of young people mobilizing. Organizations such as the Mi Familia Vota, My Family Votes. They are doing an incredible mobilization effort, going class by class, classroom by classroom, in community colleges, universities, high schools, reaching out to students, talking about how politics or the issues that they care about are related to who they vote for. So they are doing that on one side. They are also doing mobilizations to register kids that just become 18 years old, are becoming 18 years old in the last 2 years. So we're seeing a lot of, I would say, innovative ways to reach out to Latinos. Also some groups are training young Latinos to become registrars, so meaning that they can register voters. But for that in Texas, you have to have a permission. So they are training these people so they can. Register other voters in quinceañeras, in parties, in the neighborhoods. So, indeed, Latinos had historically voted more Democrats here in Texas than the Republicans, but Republicans also have a good chance to reach out to them. Actually, Vice President Pence just launched the Latinos for Trump initiative that is supposed to bring some money to the state to mobilize Latinos. Abbott is a Republican that have done a very good job in reaching out to Latinos too. But you know, if you ask me, seeing this current situation, the current state of the politics and the hostilities toward Latinos, Republicans to win this vote, Republicans had to, I would say, double the efforts, if not even, even more exponentially working to reach out to this community because they are losing them. It seems that they are losing them.
They're certainly losing the younger Hispanic voters. They seem to be voting in greater numbers, higher percentages, and they're voting very strong for Democrats. And it makes me think about Pete Wilson, Governor Pete Wilson of California, Benjamin Francis Fallon. In your look at the history of the rise of the Latino vote, his policies in California energized the Latino vote there, the Hispanic vote there, and changed California politics.
Yeah, absolutely. That's always been the understanding of events from the 1990s that Pete Wilson made California a reliably blue state. I think what it points to is that we need to think about the Latino vote in the way that political strategists are thinking about it. And when we're primarily talking about the presidential election, as we will be, presidential candidates, I don't want to be tedious here, but like they're interested in winning the Electoral College. So Donald Trump knows he's not going to win California. And so if the overall Latino polling says that Latinos disapprove of Donald Trump, and a lot of that comes from places that they're not really trying to campaign, that doesn't matter so much. The Republican strategy especially has always been to win enough of the Latino vote, not to win the Latino vote, but to win enough of it to offset both the loss of Black voters and to do so in a way that didn't alienate other members of the Republican coalition. So there is definitely a ceiling on what Republicans can do with Latino voters as long as the Republican base is white and conservative on immigration as it is. So I guess the point I would make is we shouldn't be surprised that Mike Pence rolls out a Latinos for Trump campaign or think that it's insincere. We should appreciate that where it is targeted is at a particular segment of Latinos, especially in Florida. That was where that campaign rolled out.
Sure, and that that's where you have Cuban voters.
To win enough. Yes.
But Hispanic voter turnout is increasing faster in states like Arizona, Colorado, Georgia, New Mexico, North Carolina, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. These are swing states. This is where that really matters.
Sure. And the Republican appeal, if that's, again, what we want to keep talking about, is not centered on immigration or has not historically been centered on immigration. The Republican appeal, as you said, has been to this sort of small business community, has been around questions of taxes, has been around how can we have sort of upward mobility in society through free enterprise, not through particularly government programs. So there are Republicans have over the years developed a lot of different ways of talking to Latino voters that emphasize their sort of middle class concerns and de-emphasize immigration. And I suspect that those are the points in those battleground states that Republicans will be emphasizing as they will, you know, the economy rather than what's happening.
But healthcare, Olivia Talley, you point out that healthcare is a significant issue with Latino voters. It's their top issue. And the Republican Party, they're challenging Obamacare here in Texas in the courts. They don't seem to have a replacement for it. Is that going to be something that's going to be for Latino voters?
I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I think it's going to have an impact in the way they will vote. Remember that in Texas, we also didn't have the expansion of Medicare, which would have covered a lot of people, not only Latinos, but people in the mid-range income. So, yes, healthcare, I mean, and Texas is among the bottom the bottom states in the country when it comes to
So is the takeaway that the Latino vote has risen, and it's still not, it's still up in the air. It could land in lots of areas or just enough. So I want to thank both of our guests, Benjamin Francis Fallon, professor of history at Western Carolina University and author of the forthcoming book, The Rise of the Latino Vote, A History. It's from the University of Harvard Press. Also, Olivia Talley, senior reporter covering Latino issues and culture for the Houston Chronicle. Thank you for your help in understanding this issue. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Ken Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia, and Jan Ross Piedad. Dan Katz is TPR's news director.